Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Saturday, March the 23rd, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Later on in this episode, we'll be bringing you our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll feature dispatches on the efforts by the Republic of Zimbabwe to contain a cholera outbreak in the country. A Rwandan living in the United States has been charged in the federal courts for not revealing his role in the 1994 genocide. There are water shortages in the Republic of South Africa. We have details on that as well. And the financial institutions in the West African state of Ghana are trying to cope with an internet outage impacting several African states. In the second hour, we listened to an extensive interview with South African Minister of Foreign Affairs, Dr. Naledi Pandor, on the legal claims made by Pretoria against the State of Israel for its war against the Palestinians in Gaza. Later, we look back on the literary contributions of Ann Petrie, Lorraine Hansberry, and Lorraine Hansberry as part of our commemoration of International Women's History Month. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude in the Republic of South Africa with Leta Umbulu from the 1973 album entitled Naturally. Let's listen in.
Won't you come along with me? We'll be right back.
thing about love. All it teaches can't hang on love. While preach about love. Really, really.
Thank you.
forever when nature made me a woman. She meant for me to take my place beside you. I'll never, never leave you, darling. When hot times come a-knocking, I'm gonna take my place beside you. I'll never, 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 never leave you, darling. No.
Now we may begin.
Escucha. Oh, mama. Don't be gone in now. Simple mama, simple mama. Onye nezize. Oh, mama. Don't be gone in now. Simple mama. Onye nezinja. Oh, no, big on in it. Tim Gilliman, Tim Gilliman. Yet on the season. Ah, mama. Don't be on in it. Tim Gilliman, Tim Gilliman. Yet on the season. Ah, mama. Don't be on in it.
Voice of Leta Mbulu from the Republic of South Africa. That was from a classic album released in 1973 entitled Naturally. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast for this Saturday, March the 23rd, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we'd like to move into our Pan-African Newswire report. These are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. In the southern African state of Zimbabwe, the new measures that have been adopted by the cabinet this week to reduce risk of cholera transmission and infection will have many other benefits besides the primary one of pushing back on what appears to be a remarkably sticky cholera outbreak. The ban on occupation of new housing before services such as sewage are connected will ensure that all future new housing has guaranteed sanitary safety before anyone moves in. At the same time, it will help provide an additional legal tool to ensure that proper town planning procedures are carried out, something some councils and especially Harare City Council were very slack in doing during the era of the land barons. When something is needed for public health and connection to the sewers and a water supply are obvious requirements for public health in urban areas, additional legal demands fall on both central and local governments. And in other news taking place in the United States, a Rwandan-born man living in Ohio was arrested just 2 days ago on charges he engaged in a three-decade scheme to conceal his involvement in the African nation's 1994 genocide some three decades ago to enter the United States as a refugee, and ultimately to gain United States citizenship. Federal prosecutors in Boston said that for years, Eric Nshimi, who is 52 years old now, hid the fact that he participated in the massacre by the hardline Hutu regime of an estimated 800,000 ethnic Tutsis and moderate Hutus during a three-month slaughter in 1994. In fact, he participated in the killings, including by striking victims on the head with a nail-studded club before hacking them to death with a machete. This is according to the federal prosecutors in the United States. Years later, after settling in Ohio, in Chamie, sought to derail any investigation into his scheme by lying at the immigration fraud trial of a former classmate who prosecutors have accused of also participating in the atrocities. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In South Africa, the Western Cape Department of Water and Sanitation has reiterated a call for residents to use water sparingly. This is a Globe Mark Water World Water Day on Friday. Yesterday, a day marked to highlight issues including access to good water quality and preservation of water resources. Provincial head of the department, Ntom Bizanile Bila Mpariwa, said the theme for this year is leveraging water for peace. That is why we are collaborating with our partners as national, provincial, as well as local spheres of our government to resolve water and sanitation related issues, whilst the Western Cape Dam levels are healthier than the previous years, unquote. Meanwhile, an organization in the Eastern Cape advocating for access to water, the Gift of Clean Water, said drinking water quality in the province has deteriorated. And finally, in regard to this segment of our program, an internet outage under sea has impacted services in several African states. In the West African state of financial and utility service providers in the country have been asked to host critical services locally following the recent internet service disruption due to damages to undersea cables that provide international connectivity to Ghana. This is contained in update number 5 from the National Communications Authority, the NCA, since the service disruption happened last Thursday, March the 14th, 2024. Per the statement from the NCA, the decision was taken at a meeting with a number of stakeholder organizations, including financial and utility service providers, regulators, telcos, internet exchanges, and subsea cable operators. With that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Journal and also the Pan-African Newswire, if you want to reach the Pan-African Newswire, just log on to panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to this program, the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast for today, March 23rd, 2024, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. Motown Sound, Detroit's own Marvelettes from Inkster, Michigan, a suburb just west of the city limits, that track entitled Danger. You're listening to the Pat African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, March 23rd, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit, and March is International Women's History Month. We're going to go today from the contemporary to the legendary. And we're going to start out with South African Foreign Minister Dr. Naledi Pandor in a recent interview. She has taken the lead along with the ANC government of filing a lawsuit claiming genocide, violation of the Genocide Convention of 1948 against the State of Israel for its policies in Gaza. Let's listen to this interview.
In an era shaped by the balance of power rather than the principles of justice and equality, the plight of Palestine stands as a stark reminder of the failures of the global system as the West's rules-based order clashes with international law. While Israel's powerful allies remain conspicuously silent, who will hold it to account?
It's really worrying that it's only countries of the South. The real test will be, will the most powerful join or do more?
South Africa's Foreign Minister, Naledi Pandor, tells us why her country could not stand idly by. Hello, I'm Rida Fakhri. Welcome to Bigger Than Five. In today's world, the traditional influence of the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council is being questioned, and the Western-dominated international system is being challenged by new emerging forces from the global South. From our new vantage point here in London, we look at how the global order is being reshaped. Israel's relentless war on Gaza has exposed the glaring inequalities and biases in the international system. Supported by the United States and many Western governments, Israel's military offensive in Gaza has continued despite an order by the International Court of Justice to end all plausible acts of genocide. The case against Israel at the ICJ was brought by South Africa under the 1948 Genocide Convention. South Africa, a victim of the colonial apartheid system, has long stood in solidarity with the Palestinian people in their struggle against occupation and oppression. In 1997, President Nelson Mandela said, "Our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of Palestinians." Today, despite the economic and political risks, South Africa is seeking justice for the tens of thousands of Palestinian victims of Israel's war on Gaza. My interview with South Africa's foreign minister in just a moment, but first, how the rules-based international order has become a catchphrase used by Western countries to control and influence, and the growing chorus of voices opposing it.
We need all continents to rise up in defense for the rules-based order.
In a world where international rules-based order matters,
we must defend and reform the rules-based international order.
We intend first and foremost to reaffirm the rules-based international order.
We wrote these rules. We should follow them.
The rules were never published, were never even announced by anyone to anyone.
Apoyan tirar bombas sobre la gente porque están haciendo una demostración sobre la humanidad toda.
Why this hypocrisy? Why this selective and ambivalent attitude?
This cannot go on indefinitely, nor will it go unchallenged.
Até quando que a gente vai ter medo? Até quando que a gente vai se curvar?
Today's global order is not working for everyone. In fact, it's not working for anyone.
The scale of the devastation inflicted on Gaza and the failure of the United Nations to act has renewed calls for action outside the UN Security Council, where the US has repeatedly used its veto to shield Israel from accountability. Now, while some Western governments stand accused of complicity, developing nations have become the world's moral compass. One of the loudest voices for justice is South Africa. I recently sat down with the country's foreign minister, Naledi Pandor. South Africa has managed to do what very few countries have ever dared to, which is take on Israel and its powerful Western allies. Will the existing international order, do you believe, deliver justice eventually for Palestinians?
I hope that the ICJ decisions will help to deliver justice. I don't think there'll be an entirely positive response, as we've seen, from the government of Israel, because we do believe there's a deadly intent of genocide toward the people of Palestine. And given that intention and the massive arms support that Israel enjoys from parts of the international community, I think they believe that they can thumb their nose at everybody and do as they wish. And it has been, you know, so many decades of abuse without the world really responding in a positive manner to draw the two countries together toward a settlement. So while I believe the ICJ has made a very, very important set of decisions and affirmed our belief that it is plausible that a process of genocide is underway, the response thus far from the Israeli government doesn't suggest a serious appreciation and acknowledgement of international law.
You have taken on powerful forces. Do you believe, given what you've just said, that it is ultimately a losing battle?
I would not want to put myself in such a pessimistic position. I believe that it is vital that we have international institutions that protect the most marginalized and vulnerable. And I think it's our duty to ensure that they work. This is why we went to the highest court to put the convention and its applicability to the test. And the court has affirmed the convention and its importance. And it is really up to countries that have a great deal of influence and power over Israel to persuade the government of Israel to finally act in accordance with all international humanitarian law, international human rights law, and to respect multilateral institutions.
In its interim ruling on the 26th of January, in fact, the ICJ ordered Israel to stop any genocidal act. Yet we've seen quite the opposite. There's been an uptick in violence against Palestinians, and as you say, powerful countries that keep arming Israel are still shielding it from any accountability.
This is the real pain, I think.
How do you change this dynamic?
Because, you know, when you have countries that have the power to create peace and stability in the world, when it is them that essentially are fueling it, what hope do smaller countries have? We believe that we must continue to use institutions such as the United Nations. We must continue to push Security Council members toward binding resolutions. By the way, the ICJ in its orders indicated to Israel that its decision on provisional measures are legally binding. In terms of the convention, they don't need an affirmation of the Security Council. With only five countries with a veto, which they use not in the interest of peace and security, but primarily in terms of their partisan political position.
Do you believe the United States and other Western countries are obstructing international justice? Are you willing to take on the US and the UK and other countries?
Well, I think my country is far too small to take on.
Is it a step too far?
The United States and other countries, they're major trading partners for South Africa. But I think in acknowledging that, we shouldn't be dishonest on questions of peace and security and on questions of the authority of international law, because it is these very old democracies established democracies that often lecture us about human rights and about human rights being universal and applying to all. Our concern has always been that while these statements are made in practice, it would appear that human rights are seen as being there for some and not for the weakest. We're asserting, if it is universal, let it be universal.
Will we see more developing countries in Africa, in Latin America, if not in the Arab world? And I wonder what you make of the silence and inaction of Arab governments. Will we see more countries take on, potentially, countries that are funding Israel's illegal occupation and war on Gaza?
I do expect that more countries of the South will. But I think it's really worrying that it's only countries of the South. The real test will be, will the most powerful join or do more? You know, the actions don't necessarily only need to be the ICJ. We've also made a referral to the ICC. There've been terrible killings, the most recent, with Palestinians trying to get aid from trucks and being fired at with live ammunition as they sought food because of starvation, forced starvation. Now, you would think if something like that were to happen to any nation, any people, the whole world would be aghast and would act immediately. This is the fairness that we're calling for. So as South Africa, we're not against anyone. We are for the Palestinian people, and I think this is very important. And with the Arab nations, I, you know, was hoping that they'll come to believe that the Abraham Accords, so-called, are dead in the water, but certainly that they'll continue to affirm, as we do, a two-state solution. I think they are really making as much effort as possible to engage in negotiations in the cessation call with Israel. I understand that, you know, when there's proximity to an issue in diplomacy, you may act rather differently than, you know, a country like South Africa might act. So rather than, you know, trying to be, you know, revolutionary or radical or sound, you know, popular, I understand that struggles occur on many fronts. But what I really would want to see is really a statement that says we're going to seize any notion of diplomatic relations until there's a step forward.
Are you disappointed that there hasn't been any economic or diplomatic action taken by any Arab governments, that it fell to South Africa to try to hold Israel accountable for genocide?
Maybe if you're further away, it's easier for you. I really don't want to criticize Arab governments. I think that's not my place, really. I would hope for stronger statements. I would hope for reaction. I mean, I think this killing of Palestinians trying to get aid, that should really say, this is disgraceful. You know, we must really take a harder step.
Is the tide beginning to turn, do you believe? South Africa went to the ICJ despite the economic and political risks that it entailed. Do you believe that public opinion has shifted and that governments will have to follow suit?
I think public opinion began to shift immediately when Israel fired upon innocent Palestinians. The protests that you saw worldwide indicated that the world is absolutely disgraced, both with the kidnapping of Israeli citizens by Hamas and the killing of innocent citizens. Because we are fair. We don't admire one part and hate another. We're saying all harm to innocent civilians is wrong. But we recognize the greater challenge, and it is the freedom and justice for Palestinian people. That is the core issue. You're dealing with the people who have been occupied for decades, and they need to have their own state and to enjoy human rights and freedom as all of us do.
What do these events in Gaza, the double standards, the hypocrisy that you're alluding to, what do they tell us about the so-called rules-based order and the fact that some countries, in this instance Israel, seem to be immune and that international law is only selectively applied?
Well, you know, rules-based has been coined by some, you know, almost to suggest that when you're dealing with international affairs, it's like a soccer match, that there's some referee somewhere who watches that rules are observed. The rules are international law. The rules are international humanitarian law. All the protocols associated with humanitarian law, those are the rules that we all should act by. There are no other rules. So this notion of international rules, where are they written? It is the instruments, the conventions. These are the rules. The Security Council should be providing peace and security, should be ensuring the innocent are protected, should ensure that the resolutions year after year after year on Palestine are acted upon. They've not been.
Do you expect this to be a tipping point, a turning point, a watershed moment, or is that wishful thinking? How do you overturn the institutional biases that have led us here?
I think it should be a turning point, because if we don't seize this moment, I think we're going to have a worse situation. Firstly, the real danger is more harm to Palestinian people. The second is much more of the world will come to believe international instruments don't matter, and so I can abuse as I wish, and that is deadly for people who don't have arms and who don't have protection, and we cannot afford that in the world today. The third harm will be to the United Nations body, our premier global institution. If we don't protect its ability to be our global multilateral institution, we're going to see the mushrooming of a whole host of institutions and further division in the world. So at this moment, what we need is leadership. We need leaders who understand the moment, who understand that the geopolitical divide is a danger to the entire global community, and they have to stand up and confront the most difficult problems in a realistic fashion.
Do we have these leaders? South Africa showed leadership.
We're looking for them. We hope that they'll emerge. There are many leaders in the world. A lot of them are talking the right language with respect to a two-state solution. I'm very focused at the moment on Palestine, and I believe this is an issue we should address, but there are many issues on the African continent as well that require attention. There are leaders, and I think they now need to stand up.
On Palestine, you have shown leadership, South Africa has, so has Brazil, and other countries as well. Do you expect to see serious repercussions as a result of the stance you took? Do you expect to see full-blown U.S. sanctions applied against South Africa, and what would you do if that were the case?
Well, I don't. I hope that that won't happen. I know there's a threat. There are some resolutions that have been tabled by members of the House of Representatives against South Africa. I must say, frankly, I'm astounded because I thought nations have a sovereign right to determine their own foreign policy. I've never understood international relations to mean what Turkey says is what South Africa must say, or what the United States says is what I must say. I believe that's very patronizing, and I hope that those intentions won't reach any level of implementation. I don't believe the American people are like that, but we'll continue to lobby, to talk to them. We believe to act in that way against South Africa would be really beyond the pale.
But how are you preparing for the prospect of U.S. sanctions? How economically devastating would it be for South Africa?
It would be very, very bad for South Africa. But we must continue to build our economy. We must continue to expand trade with the African continent. So I believe that it's very important that nations are not made to be afraid of being independent, because then we'll have a really terrible world. And trade shouldn't be used as a form of blackmail to tell you how you should conduct yourself. What we should learn to do is to speak to each other in the appropriate fora or in our bilateral engagements, in order to understand the perspectives each of us hold. As freedom-loving people who had to wage a struggle against the evil of apartheid and racism, we can't stand idly by when others experience apartheid forms of discrimination or the kind of subjugation that the Palestinian people have been forced into.
In your pursuit of justice, not just for Palestinians, you've also criticized other international legal instruments, the ICC, for their uneven-handed approach following their arrest warrant for the Russian President Vladimir Putin. You've also said in late 2023 that you expected the ICC to issue an arrest warrant for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Do you still believe that that could happen?
Well, I certainly hope so, because the crimes that have been committed are indeed, in our view, war crimes against humanity. We also have said the ICC should investigate war crimes against Hamas as well. So we've been even-handed in our referral to the ICC. When we met the leadership of the ICC recently to check where our referral is in terms of process and to express our concern that the ICC seemed to act very speedily when it came to issuing a warrant for President Putin concerning the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, but that we were not seeing this fast pace in this terrible plight of the Palestinian people. They informed us that they are investigating. I said, but how long is it going to take? Because it was very quick on the one side, and it's not as speedy on the other, and we'd like to see action. So we are still waiting up to today.
Do you believe that the ICC has been a tool in Western hands? Because for the most part, they have also pursued cases that have only targeted African leaders. Do you believe that to be the case?
We had come to have the view that it was focused primarily as an anti-African leaders institution. But after much discussion, we felt it's important to have such a body, hence we decided to remain within it. But we do still remain concerned. And often it's issues of funding, it would seem, that whoever provides the greatest resources, and of course the weakness is that the more significant countries of the world have not signed on to the Rome Statute.
The United States being one of them.
Being one, indeed.
South Africa has long complained about the fact that the Global South, which represents about 85% of the world's population, is on the margin of global decision-making, that political and financial institutions are in the hands of a few Western nations. BRICS countries, in fact, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, make up 40% of the world's population. They account for a quarter of the global economy. Can they, do you believe, reshape global governance so that the world's majority has an equal voice in decisions that affect their futures?
I think it's their responsibility to try hard to do so, because we can't leave things as they are. India is a significant part of the world, both in economic terms and in terms of population size, but they're not on the Security Council. They're not a leader in institutions of global governance. So that must change. Africa was still colonized when the United Nations was established. And since we achieved independence, we don't have an African representation permanently on the Security Council. Other matters of reform include the ability to enforce peace. Had we had a peace enforcement capacity in the United Nations, we would not have 30,000 plus Palestinians dead, nor 30,000 plus Ukrainians dead. So clearly there is a need for reform of global governance in the world. But secondly, the most unfair practices are felt in the international financial system, where many of us are bound to the dollar. And we've often posed the question, why can't we trade in multiple currencies? Let's look at developing systems that allow us to do so. So last year as BRICS, we've taken up the cudgels and we've established a task force made up of central bank governors and ministers of finance of the BRICS countries, and we're investigating this matter of trading internationally in our own currencies or multiple currency trade. So let's see what the result of that will be. It's a big step, but it does begin to challenge the received wisdom that, you know, certain countries must drive everything.
Naledi Pandor, Minister of International Relations and Cooperation of the Republic of South Africa, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
As South Africa refuses to stand by, other emerging nations are also mounting their own challenges to a global order that is based on outdated and undemocratic power structures. Leaders in the Global South are shaking up the status quo, using international law to address injustices around the world. The pursuit of justice for Palestine symbolizes the struggle against neocolonialism, as a growing number of governments refuse to play by the rules imposed by a handful of nations. From me, Rita Fahri, and the team, thanks for watching.
Welcome back. And that was an interview with South African Foreign Minister, Dr. Naledi Pandor, on the South African stance on the situation in Palestine, taking legal action against the State of Israel. And here's another interview with Dr. Naledi Pandor. Let's listen to this interview as well.
If we fail, we will allow the Israelis to continue with this practice. Thank you.
Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad, President of Iran, will take the floor.
In December, as civilian casualties escalated in Gaza, the South African government took a very dramatic step, presenting a petition at the world's highest court, the International Court of Justice, accusing Israel of genocide. And in January, in a remarkable ruling, the ICJ found it plausible that Israel's acts could indeed amount to genocide. Now, the Israelis, of course, and their allies in Washington and London have loudly denied that what's happening in Gaza is a genocide, and Israel has even accused South Africa of being the legal arm of Hamas. Nevertheless, the South African government has won plaudits across the world for its effort to hold Israel to account, and the face of that international effort is the country's foreign minister, Dr. Naledi Pandor. She joins me, she joins Zateo for our very first interview here in Washington, D.C. Minister, thank you for joining us on Zateo.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
There are 192 member nations of the United Nations aside from Israel. Why was it South Africa that decided to bring this pretty historic, pretty monumental petition, genocide petition, to the International Court of Justice? How did it all come about? Whose idea was it in South Africa to do this?
I think it had to be South Africa, really, because the only country that has a similar experience to the Palestinian people and that has been firmly attached to their struggle for freedom and human rights is South Africa. We have a long association. I've been explaining while here that our interest and concern about Palestine didn't begin on October 8th. And really, given our experience of international solidarity and support from almost the entire world community, we felt that that support, that solidarity movement that our leaders really sought and initiated, placed an obligation on us where there is patent harm to actually try to do something. So the initiator was the Minister of Justice. But before him, I had received many letters from human rights lawyers and activists in South Africa, including eminent legal professionals, all saying, there's the convention, you know, on genocide. Why don't you do something, South Africa?
So on that note, your lawyers at the ICJ in The Hague put out a very detailed case back in January. But just for the sake of our viewers watching at home, it's a big charge, the genocide charge. Just briefly, why do you believe Israel is guilty of genocide? It's, of course, a charge Israel denies, its allies, the United States, denies. Why do you believe, briefly, Israel is guilty of genocide?
Well, firstly, the evidence in our view is very clear. If you look at the Genocide Convention, which was actually crafted post the Second World War, with particular reference to the experience of Jewish people in Europe, and its aspects detail, firstly, that there's a focus on a group with an intent to erase a group, that the measures taken by the aggressor actually seek to ensure that there is no life and that an entire group is eradicated. There's a very specific focus and a range of actions that all speak to leading to death.
As you know, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, your counterpart, called your ICJ petition meritless and galling. The White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby called it meritless, counterproductive, completely without any basis in fact whatsoever. What is your response to the U.S. government when you hear statements like that?
Well, firstly, one of the things that I've been intrigued by while being in government and politics is that all of us call for attachment to a range of instruments that are set in place to protect humanity. But the minute those instruments are utilized, if it is against a friend, then we complain. But when it is utilized and directed at what we regard as an enemy, then we appreciate the international instrument. This has been one of the reasons for us constantly referring to a double standard approach to international frameworks. So I would say, and this has been said to me even by some of my colleagues who are foreign ministers, the very galling, counterproductive, etc. And I said to them, well, fortunately, what the United Nations system has created is a court with eminent jurists within it, and it is their decision and judgment.
Yeah.
We weren't seeking the judgment of partners, of friends, of commentators. One colleague told me that she has studied law. I congratulated her on that. However, she's not a judge of the International Court of Justice. It's their duty both to scrutinize what we submit, what Israel submits, and make a judgment.
And to be clear, the court has said it is plausible that Israel could be committing genocide. You mentioned America not liking you taking action against its friend. You are here in Washington, D.C. in the U.S. You've been having meetings on Capitol Hill. Are you worried at all about this bipartisan bill introduced in Congress last month, which calls for a full review of U.S. relations with South Africa and questions whether South Africa is engaged in activities that undermine U.S. national security and foreign policy, basically seeks to punish your country for going to the ICJ. But it's a bipartisan bill.
Yeah, indeed it is. And it will come, I suspect, before the House. And I've been told by public representatives that it does have a bipartisan support. So I think it would be most unfortunate if it is passed, and so part of my presence here is to affirm the bilateral relationship between South Africa and the United States. I think these are two important democracies in their regions, and it's important that they get on well. Also, I believe that to have South Africa as an enemy, or to have a frosty relationship, will impact on the relationship with the entire African continent, because South Africa is so key on the continent. So I'm really seeking to advise that we be calm and measured in our approach and look at ways in which together we might be a better force for good in the world.
So if, as you say, and the South African government says, that Israel is guilty of genocide in Gaza, in your view, and the United States is funding Israel, arming Israel, protecting Israel from UN Security Council resolutions with its veto, Is the United States government, is President Biden complicit in that genocide?
Well, we tabled an allegation which has to be proved by the International Court of Justice. We've named Israel and mentioned Palestine and the Palestinian people. We've not named any other country, but the convention does indicate that parties implicated would also be identified by the court. So it's very important that we allow the legal process to ensue. I'm not in a business of naming this one or the other. I really respect the processes and want them to be followed.
But you do believe Israel is guilty of genocide?
Indeed, we've said there is strong evidence in our view.
Yeah.
And the court
but you
has
won't
to
say that America is helping Israel with that
genocide?
I don't think
that's my business. I think the court must identify whether there are any others who may be complicit.
I mean, you said last week you issued a call to South Africans to protest the war outside the embassies of the five primary supporters of Israel.
Yes, indeed.
Which five supporters?
I believe protest is important. I think people do know who the five are.
They certainly do.
If they don't, they must do their homework.
I'm sure my mum doesn't know.
Who's
she's
providing
arms?
I bet you she does.
Who are the five?
I bet you your mum knows.
Okay, let's go to the U.S., the UK.
The U.S., UK.
France.
Germany has been a very strong supporter. France, four. And others, the European Union in its collective. So I think...
So you would like to protest outside the EU embassy and those four embassies?
How do you get change?
Okay.
I wish I could be in Gaza and stand in front of a Palestinian family and be strong enough to protect them. That's what I wish I could do. Because I'm pained that I have to watch on TV essentially a murder underway. And I am helpless and can do nothing. This was very much the experience we had under apartheid. And it was mass protest, mass struggle, which made a major contribution to indicating to the world that this could not go on any longer. So for us to be invisible in a massive human struggle where we know huge murder is underway, I think that is unacceptable. And the world should be horrified. And having large protests with a million is insufficient. There has to be an ongoing campaign to say to the world, this can't be.
I have to ask again one more time. You say a huge murder is underway. That's a big charge, genocide, murder.
Mm-hmm.
You say protest outside the US embassy because they are helping Israel. So is the United States then, according to the logic you're presenting, is the UK, is Germany, are they accomplices to that murder?
Well, they're certainly supporting Israel and have said so publicly. Only recently have they said Israel has a right to defend itself, but it must not harm innocent people. Unfortunately, when you have a bomb, it's very difficult for the bomb to decide who's innocent and who's guilty.
They have these big dumb bombs that are killing more than just, quote-unquote, the terrorists. In terms of stopping the killing, in its initial ruling in January, which you called a major victory, the ICJ agreed that it is plausible that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza, ordered Israel to take immediate and effective measures to increase humanitarian aid and take all measures within its power to prevent genocidal acts, which was undeniably a big deal from the ICJ. It's major, as you say, but the court did not call for a ceasefire as requested by your petition. So that was a partial defeat for South Africa and a partial win for Israel, was it not?
Well, yes, indeed. It was a disappointment, as I indicated in the media briefing after the court case. But we had anticipated that it would be very difficult for the court to issue that kind of instruction, particularly given the inability of the Security Council to lead on this matter. But I do think the fact of the provisional measures that were agreed to was a very important decision in global affairs. I also think that had those measures been pursued by Israel, they would require a ceasefire in order to be acted upon.
You've also gone back to the ICJ to urge the court to issue emergency orders for Israel to increase humanitarian aid as a famine looms in Gaza. The Israelis have responded to the court. They've called your actions an abuse of the Genocide Convention and even morally repugnant. Do you believe Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war?
I think so, indeed, that is happening. And it's not thought. We've seen children dying. from hunger and starvation. So yes, this is happening, and I'm not surprised. As I've said, insults are the last refuge of a scoundrel. I'm being called all sorts of names. It's fine. I can be called the worst name. If we could save the lives of Palestinians, I wouldn't complain.
You mentioned earlier about your experience, South Africa's experience, the history with Palestinians. Let's talk about apartheid. You were born in apartheid South Africa. Your late father, Joe Matthews, was a famous anti-apartheid activist. Do you believe that Israel is guilty of the crime of apartheid? Because Israelis often say it's offensive and disrespectful to the South Africans who struggled against apartheid to compare the Palestinians to that struggle. So it'd be interesting to ask a South African government official, what do you think about the apartheid analogy?
Well, I respond in this way. If I cannot travel on a particular form of transport because of my nationality, what is that? I could not travel on particular forms of transport in South Africa because of my nationality. If I cannot own my land and be certain that I have a freehold over it and can retain it in perpetuity for generations, what is that but apartheid? If I have my land broken up into pockets which are supervised by particular authorities and I need permits in order to enter into that land, if I'm reserved in terms of movement to move within a particular corridor and have barriers placed that indicate which part of that corridor I can walk in, and as I proceed all along it, I have to produce identity documents. If I can be arrested, detained, without charge, without bail, not knowing why I'm in a prison, what wrong I have done, what else compares to this? I just can't imagine. If I live in ghettos, like townships, and this is where I must live.
Do you believe what's happening in the West Bank and Gaza is worse than apartheid South Africa?
I think the onslaught that we're seeing now is certainly much worse. I think it would have been difficult for the world to countenance that happening in apartheid South Africa. But we had Boipatong and many other massacres. Yes. Tomorrow we'll celebrate Sharpeville, Human Rights Day. Commemorate, not celebrate. So we've had terrible incidents. I don't think that what is happening between Israel and Palestine is absolutely complementary to the apartheid. Yes. Experience, because a lot of it is not framed in legislation. But the experience has a lot of complementarity. And respected international organizations,
yes, they have,
which many leaders listen to, yes, have done thorough research on this question.
Yes, they have, including Israeli human rights groups. Minister, you made a pretty stark statement last week saying that upon their return, South Africa will arrest dual nationals who have been fighting with the Israeli military in Gaza. There's even been talk from your foreign ministry in the past of stripping them of their citizenship if they're dual nationals. What law would they be violating? And won't your critics inevitably say that you are guilty of anti-Semitism for targeting your country's Jewish minority community, from which these dual nationals, of course, emerge?
Well, we have a law on mercenary activity, and it indicates that if you're a citizen of South Africa, you cannot participate in conflict in another country without having approached the authorities in South Africa and provided an indication that you have an intention to assist in a country, and given perhaps the likelihood that this is an ally, the authorities may very well grant that you are able to act in that way. But without such a reference to the appropriate authority, you're actually conducting an illegal act. I can't recall the name of the particular act, but we do have such an act.
But you're not worried about stripping Jewish South Africans of South African citizenship?
Well, I think the prosecutorial authorities know the law, and they have the responsibility to execute in this regard.
Do you believe Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu should be prosecuted at the ICC, at the International Criminal Court? Should he be arrested for violations of international law, for war crimes, whenever he travels abroad?
I think a warrant should have been issued by now. We had made a submission to the ICC. We've not heard anything for months.
But you would like to see an arrest warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu?
I believe that the ICC needs to make a decision as to whether, in terms of war crimes, are they being committed. It's not my decision. The ICC is an appropriate authority. We wrote to it with our observations on what is happening. They must make the decision, same as they did with the Russian president and others.
So you mentioned the Russian president, and earlier in the interview, you very eloquently and, in my view, rightly talked about the double standards when it comes to the West and its friends. What about your critics, South Africa's critics, who say you're guilty of double standards? You want this ICC arrest warrant for Netanyahu, but when former Sudanese president Omar al-Bashir visited South Africa in 2015, your country failed to arrest him, even though he was wanted at the time by the ICC for war crimes and genocide in Darfur. Last summer, your government tried to get permission from the ICC to not arrest Vladimir Putin, Russian president, when he was planning on visiting South Africa for the BRICS summit, even though there's an arrest warrant from the ICC for him. Your critics say that's a double standard on South Africa's part.
Well, it's plausible for them to have that argument. And indeed, we were very alert that they did approach the ICC, and our anticipation was that once they had approached it on one harm, they would approach the ICC on all harm. And our observation is that that doesn't happen. With respect to al-Bashir, you know that we had a particular court ruling, and so we did approach the ICC to seek clarity as to what we do in the likelihood that President Putin may come to South Africa. Our courts had a clear decision, and we had to act in terms of the court decision of South Africa.
Do you support the arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin?
So should President Putin have come, we would have been in a very difficult situation, and I think would have had to effect the decision of the court.
Do you support the decision to put out arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin?
Well, it's not whether I support or not.
Well, it is, because you support it for Netanyahu. I'm asking if you support it for Putin.
I think for any leader who commits harm against innocent civilians and breaches international law, there should be a warrant.
It's not just Vladimir Putin, is it? In January, in the same month that you went to the ICJ over Gaza, South Africa and President Ramaphosa himself hosted a man named Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, a Sudanese general, a Sudanese warlord whose militia has been accused of ethnic cleansing and war crimes, not just by the US, but by human rights groups that we just mentioned, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. That's a pretty bad look for South Africa to be hosting a man accused of genocide in Sudan, while at the same time you're in The Hague accusing Israel of genocide.
Indeed, the gentleman, Mr. Hemeti, was in South Africa invited by a non-governmental organization that is focusing on conflict resolution in Sudan and has had various iterations of meetings with the two contending groups. Mr. Hemeti, he asked the NGO to request us to arrange a meeting for him with President Ramaphosa, which we did. Following that, last month, we had the vice president of the Transitional Council of Sudan, who's on the other side. So we are talking to all parties, which is part of what we do in South Africa.
Understood. Would you, just trying to follow the logic of the argument, would you also host then Mahmoud Abbas and Benjamin Netanyahu, should he want to come to South Africa?
I think that would be a difficult one for us.
Yeah, maybe right now Netanyahu might not want to book a flight to Johannesburg.
I doubt that. Well, they've cancelled flights to South Africa.
Indeed. Okay, let's just talk more broadly before we run out of time about this conflict. You, Minister, I believe, are a convert to Islam. And you know a lot of people see the Israel-Palestine issue through a religious prism. It's seen as through a religious prism, as Muslims versus Jews, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism. How much of a problem is the religious component to this conflict in your view, or the religious angles that people apply to it?
Well, I think it's a challenge. It does blind people's analysis and interpretation. I act in terms of human rights law and by direction of our government. The decision on the ICJ wasn't mine, despite the fact that my mouth is the one that speaks most on it. This was a decision of the cabinet of South Africa. And as the minister responsible for administration of the convention, I'm the public face of this. The matter of my religion does not feature. But of course, as Muslims, we always, by principle, are influenced by the values we live by. However, I do think that there is an element in which religion is utilized. For example, this notion that by questioning Israel, you're anti-Semitic. You know, this is a kind of weapon used to stop you from challenging these practices. And I think this is something that we should all resist. And I have said to our community in South Africa that it's a question of human rights. And we need to, as we speak to it and support Palestinian people, be clear that this is an issue of rights.
I want to briefly turn towards an internal issue related to South Africa before we finish. You have right-wing people here in America, including South African-born Elon Musk, who rather hysterically, even conspiratorially, claim there is a genocide of white people in South Africa, and they point to the killing of white farmers, even to the anti-apartheid-era song used at the rallies of opposition party leader Julius Malema, not by the ANC, but by Malema, called Kill the Boer, a term for white Afrikaners. What is your response, Minister, I'm wondering, to this increasing number of claims coming out of the U.S. conservative movement, U.S. right-wing media, Elon Musk, saying white genocide in South Africa?
I think it's very easy to label black people because we tend to see black people as having no principles and values. People define themselves as very civilized and blacks as uncivilized, and they expect the worst from us. None can believe that we are trying to build the most diverse United Nation in the world, that we practice democracy very, very actively. We're a robust, open society. We have full freedom of expression, but we haven't got rid of our racism. Just 2 weeks ago, we have a few three brothers in court for the murder of their farm workers, and little is said about that. We'd like to eradicate all such racist incidents, including farm murders, but all murders as well. The violence of apartheid, which many tolerated for decades and took very long to act upon, has left a society that is in deep pain and that is scarred by its history. So to all of those who comment, I really say, you know, they're not helpful, and there's a lot of dishonesty in the statements that they make.
What do you make of Elon Musk, who perhaps, with the exception of the late Nelson Mandela, is perhaps the most famous South African in the world? A lot of people think he's using Twitter, X, to elevate far-right racists, anti-Semites, and others. What do you make of Musk as a South African?
Well, most South Africans are the children of Nelson Mandela, and they try and commit in their actions to lifting out the best in people. And I think if you haven't had experience of Mandela, if you don't appropriate his values, then your conduct will be most unfortunate. I don't know Mr. Musk. I can't comment on him, really. I have not met him, and I doubt that I ever will. But we would wish that wherever South Africans are, they really contribute positively to society.
Is he?
And to building
is
a world.
Is he contributing positively in America?
I don't know, but I'm saying that's what I wish South Africans would do. Because I believe out of our experience of a struggle against apartheid, a mighty struggle where we learned values of appreciating freedom, justice and rights for all, and really that human dignity was a key element of what we prized, this is how we should conduct ourselves. And whenever we take an action where we diminish human dignity, as South Africans, we should be worried.
You're very popular abroad right now as a government, but you're not very popular at home as a government. Is that because of the state of the economy, the level of corruption, the level of murders, the rolling power cuts? Why is it that the polls are now suggesting you may, for the first time, the ANC get less than 50% of the vote?
Well, firstly, I think ANC must campaign properly and very hard. I hope that we do get a majority. Certainly, there are concerns. There are failures by the ANC government. Young people are very angry about not having enough opportunities or any opportunity at all. And certainly, corruption has been a blight on our march to freedom and transition. We are addressing corruption. President Ramaphosa has been resolute in the fight, and he must continue it. So I believe South Africa, after the election, will have the African National Congress as the biggest party. And I
as
certainly,
the biggest party,
I believe
but
that
not necessarily
no,
majority.
We'll get
be
a majority. My view, my belief is we'll get a
but you're not ruling
a
out
majority.
A coalition.
I don't support coalitions. I think they're a disaster.
You're not ruling out the coalition.
I don't support coalition. We
so,
must campaign
I'll
for
take that
a
as
majority.
You're not ruling it out. Last question for you. I'd appreciate your time. When I'm in pro-Palestinian or Arab-American or Muslim or left-wing or young circles, and anyone mentioned South Africa right now, people cheer. They're happy. They see South Africa having stuck up for international justice, international law. Have you experienced that personally as foreign minister, this new sense of goodwill towards your country on the international stage? And if so, how do you plan to leverage that goodwill or use it going forward? I just wonder.
We've always had goodwill, largely because of who we are and the history that we have. I think, yes, there's certainly much more attention on South Africa. Even those who may dislike us and believe it's without merit, they whisper, you know, you did something important. So I'm not sure that we should leverage it because I think that would be an abuse. Our approach to the ICJ was a genuine a step on our part, and I don't think we should use it or abuse it in a deleterious manner. We must continue to do our bilateral work, which is what I'm doing, wherever we can, because international partnerships and diplomacy are important. I believe we live in an increasingly divided world, and I think leaders need to pause and look at how we draw the world back together to a common agenda.
Minister Pandor, we will have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for appearing on the table today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us.
Welcome back. And that was an interview with South African Minister for International Relations and Cooperation, the Foreign Minister, Dr. Naledi Pandor, speaking on yesterday in an interview done here in the United States. And we'll take a break and we'll be back with the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio broadcast for today. And we're broadcasting live from our studio in downtown.
Like a refugee up Highway 61, looking for salvation in the city. They recognize each and every one. I hear the cries, the shuffling of their feet, like a heart that just won't stop, keeps on beating. A thousand echoes whisper down the street.
Track entitled Wayward Saints of Memphis, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special Pan-African Journal worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, March 23rd, 2024, and we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'll continue with our International Women's History Month commemoration. This segment will focus on the legendary writer and journalist Anne Petrie, was born on October 12th of 1908. She made her transition on April 28th of 1997. She was an African-American writer of novels, short stories, children's books, and journalism. Her 1946 debut novel, The Street, became the first novel by an African-American woman to sell more than a million copies. In 2019, the Library of America published a volume of her work containing The Street, as well as her 1953 masterpiece, The Narrows, and a few shorter pieces of nonfiction. So Anne was born as Anne Houston Lane in Old Saybrook, Connecticut. She was the youngest of three daughters to Peter Clark Lane and Bertha James Lane. Her parents belonged to the African-American minority, numbering about 15 inhabitants of the small town. Her father was a pharmacist and her mother was a shop owner, owning a hairdressing establishment, and was also the niece of Anne Louise James, the first African-American woman pharmacist in the state of Connecticut. Anne and her sister were raised in the classic New England tradition, a study in efficiency, thrift, and utility. They were filled with ambitions that they might not have entertained had they lived in a city, along with thousands of other impoverished African-Americans stuck in demeaning jobs. In 1925, Anne graduated from high school as the only person of African descent. The family had none of the trappings of the middle class until Petrie was well into adulthood. Before her mother became a businesswoman, she worked in a factory, and her sisters worked as maids. The Lane girls were raised sheltered from most of the disadvantages that other black people in the United States had to experience due to the color of their skin. However, there were a number of incidents of racial discrimination. As Petrie wrote in My Most Humiliating Jim Crow Experience, published in Negro Digest in 1946, there was an incident where a racist decided that they did not want her on a beach. Her father wrote a letter to the crisis in 1920 or 1921 complaining about a teacher who refused to teach his daughters and his niece. Another teacher humiliated her by making her read the part of Jupiter, the illiterate ex-slave, in the Edgar Allan Poe short story, The Gold Bug. Petrie had a strong family foundation with well-traveled uncles who had many stories to tell her when coming home. Her father, who overcame racial obstacles, opened a pharmacy in the small town, and her mother and aunt set a strong example. Petrie, interviewed by the Washington Post in 1992, says about her tough family, female family members, that, quote, it never occurred to them that there were things they couldn't do because they were women. And let's listen to an interview with Anne Petrie that was done in 1975. And, of course, this was done under the auspices of Temple University. Let's listen in.
From Temple University, this is Profiles in Literature, featuring interviews with authors and illustrators prominent in American literature for children. The moderator for this series is Dr. Jacqueline N. Schachter, professor of children's literature with Temple University.
From Old Saybrook, Connecticut, comes today's guest, Anne Petrie, who writes for both children and adults. When we wanted to arrange Miss Petrie's visit, I had to contact her in Hawaii because in 1974-75 she taught literature and creative writing at the University of Hawaii. Do share anything that you think will be of interest concerning your Hawaiian experiences.
Well, I have to say first that Hawaii is so beautiful that it's unbelievable. In spite of all the stories and all the pictures, you don't really have any idea of what it's like until you are there. And that applies also to the people, who are stunning looking. I have a couple of amusing stories. One of them, when I reached the end of the spring semester in a creative writing class, I said to my students, well, now, is there anything that you would like to ask me? Do you have any questions? And I thought that they were going to ask questions about writing. And one young man, and I can only describe him as a brash young man, he really was. He was huge, great, enormous shoulders, very athletic, said, well, there is one thing I would like to know. And I said, what is that? And he said, well, what does your husband do for a living? And I said, well, of course, I'd be very happy to answer that question. But I would like to point out to you that you have been conditioned by the culture in which you live, because it would never occur to you to ask a man what his wife did for a living. And as far as what my husband does for a living, I'd be happy to tell you he is a retired advertising executive, and he used to be in New York City. And that was that. And the other story, favorite, and these are curious sidelights on Hawaii. For a while, you begin to believe that you're living in a foreign country. You have to remind yourself you actually are in a part of the United States. And then, of course, finally, I had to open a checking account in a bank. And I brought with me what is perfectly good identification in Connecticut, and also brought along a cashier's check from a savings bank, which in Connecticut is almost like, well, practically cash. But I discovered that that doesn't work in Honolulu. The only way they would permit me to deposit the check was if I had either a Hawaii state driving license or a state identification card. And I didn't have either one or the other. And therefore, I had to get an identification card. And in order to get that, I wrote to my husband and said, please send me a copy of my birth certificate and my marriage license. And he wrote back and said, what in the world does a bank need to have your birth certificate and your marriage license? Well, anyway, I took these down to the place where one issued those cards, and I'm fingerprinted and photographed. And that's the most interesting identity card, I think, of any state in the whole union.
Yes.
And most unusual.
Yes, it is.
And, of course, once I had that, I felt as though I had an actual existence. I was a person able to cash checks, buy merchandise in stores, and pay for it with a check. Up until then, I could not.
Unfortunate.
I couldn't even have a bank account.
Unfortunate. May I present the assistant coordinator of the Office on Work with Children, Ms. Ellen May Mullen, and the coordinator, Carolyn Field, my collaborator on the Profiles in Literature series. I've often felt that your works lend themselves very well to filmic adaptation. Have you ever been approached about filming any of them?
Oh, yes. Many, many times. In fact, one of my novels, The Narrows, was purchased by Columbia Pictures many years ago. And at one point, a good many years ago, I worked for Columbia Pictures. And one of the things I saw there that I always remember, one day I was walking through the hall and I saw a man pushing a sort of hand truck, and it was piled with papers. And I said, what is that? Well, he said, those are all manuscripts they've bought at various times and they never used. They took them out of the vault just now to look for something, and now they're going back in. So I assumed that the Narrows is in the vault at Columbia Pictures still sitting.
Not in too narrow a vault. May I have the pleasure of introducing Teresa Mason, a sixth grade pupil who has a question to ask you about Harriet Tubman, conductor on the Underground Railroad. Go ahead.
Hello, Miss M. Teacher. I'd like to ask you, what gave you the idea of writing Harriet Tubman?
Well, you know, I wish I could say that that was the result of a considerable amount of thought on my part. Actually, it was not. It was pure accident, and I think I ought to say most of what I write is the result of, I can only say, accident. I had been to a book and author luncheon in Hartford, Connecticut, at a department store called G. Fox & Company, and they have a sizable bookstore in the department store. And at this luncheon, I had the pleasure of sitting next to Carl Carmer. He was born and brought up in New York State, in Auburn, New York, which is where Harriet Tubman had lived. And during the course of the conversation, he said to me, have you ever thought of writing a book about Harriet Tubman? And I said, well, no, not really. I don't know anything about her. And he said, well, why don't you? I said, yes, I'll look her up and see what I think. And I looked her up and thought, well, of all the people that I'd ever heard of or encountered, I was going to write a book about Harriet Tubman. And it was really the result of an accident. If I hadn't been sitting next to him, the chances are that book would never have existed.
Well, I'm interested in the fact that so often in the story, Harriet is coming naturally to Philadelphia. So did you do any research in the city itself? And also maybe take a look at the records kept by William Still.
I owned William Grant Still's book.
Oh.
And it is one of my treasures. At the time that I wrote that book, there was really very little interest in that particular period in American history.
Mm-hmm.
And though I don't know, I have no idea these days what Still's book would possibly sell for, because it's really a treasure. And it was one of the first books that I found
And it was, you really wouldn't need to do much more research than to use that, because it is so very graphic. It is marvelously written.
Where did you find it?
In a little bookstore, a secondhand bookstore in Harlem.
No.
Yeah. And I paid $10 for it, which is a very, very low price.
Well, following Teresa's question about writing Harriet Tubman, why do you think you write basically?
Why do I write?
Right.
Well, let me think if I can. I don't know that I ever even thought about that. It's just one. I think it's the only way I can express how I feel about the world, about people. I read somewhere that people who write do it because they're displeased with the world, and they want to create worlds in which they, well, literally play God. They maneuver, manipulate. They create situations that they can control. Because we can't control much of the world. If you write, at least you control the world of your book. I think that's about it.
Following that, one of your first books for children was The Drugstore Cat, a delightful story about a little gray kitten called Buzzy. And in the story, Buzzy is concerned that a few people can understand his language. And he says, finally, I understand now. It's because the very, very young and the very, very old understand anything better than anyone else.
True.
Do you believe in this?
Oh, indeed, I do. And I do believe that there are cats. If you, I don't want to be to say really talk, but certainly you can understand what cats want. And I have a cat, and I often say to my husband about him, you know, he's swearing at us. And you can tell. I mean, you can really understand them very well indeed. And I wrote that particular book because of the fact that, you know, we're getting to be a very old family. And in my family, we hadn't had any children, any young children, no babies born. And heavens, I don't know when. And my sister had a child. And in order, in a way, to celebrate, I had to write a story for her. And we had had drugstores. We all were cat lovers. So it seemed to me really quite fitting that this particular book for this first child should have been about a cat who lived in a drugstore. And that was true, that business about the cat thumping down the stairs and frightening away the burglars actually happened.
Well, again, it shows that authors write out of their own experience.
They should.
And I think they do their best writing when they do this.
They do.
In writing about Harriet Tubman and Tituba Salem Village, were you thinking of young people learning about their past and in order to understand the present?
Yes, and I'm not sure that I don't know that I, that isn't quite the way I thought about it, though it adds up to the same thing. But when I was in high school, and I went to high school in Old Saybrook, Connecticut, in a town where the great majority of people were white. And when I was in high school, in history classes, the only mention of black people in textbooks, the history, was slavery. And we were always portrayed as being a very happy-go-lucky people who were always dancing, playing. We were childlike. And I can remember at one point I stayed home from school. Now, I had no way of proving that this wasn't true, but I knew that this was wrong. And anybody who could think and think straight would know that this was wrong. And then, of course, when I did finally decide to write a book about Harriet Tubman, I wrote it specifically for my niece, because I wanted her to know that there had existed a woman with the kind of courage that Harriet Tubman had, and that this woman had been a slave. And to me, in all history, this is the one great American heroine.
I agree.
I agree with you 100%, both about cats and Harriet Tubman.
Oh, good.
I'm a cat lover.
Well,
and
then
I
we won't have any
arguments. No, no arguments whatsoever.
So
but I would like to ask, do you enjoy doing research?
Not really.
You prefer to do the writing?
Well, I would rather do the writing. And it isn't that I dislike doing the research. It is that I find when you go back into another period, I always feel a little bit hampered. Principally because there are things that you simply cannot, you don't write freely because of the fact you're always running into the fact that something you're writing about probably didn't exist at that time. I think it's in Tituba that I mentioned when I first wrote it, something about that young man in there
and a pocket. Well, pockets were not used in that period. And it is that kind of little stumbling block that I don't like.
It's sort of nitpicking in a sense when
you're
flowing.
And you're going on and
flowing.
On. Then you go back over this and find you've done this and you've done that and take this out and take that out. I'd rather not. And yet at the same time, I feel impelled to create a picture of people who had what I call great courage.
And when you had your background with the drugstore cat, you didn't have to worry.
No,
pharmacist. Where did you do the research for Tituba? Because you must have done tremendous amount.
I should think you know the answer to that question beforehand, because you told me you had worked there in the 42nd Street Library in New York City, which is one of the world's great
libraries. I'm so glad you brought library into this.
Well, I would have to, because I owe a debt of gratitude to libraries and librarians. I really do. And as far as Tituba is concerned, some of the original documents, you know, are
right
in
there.
The 42nd Street Library. And when you go there, I think about Hawaii and its state identity card. It isn't quite that bad. But when you go, you say who you are and identify yourself and why you want to see the thing that you want to see, and you think you're in the clear.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you go up, way, way up in the library, and you finally come to a room where they have bars on the door, literally, and it is a locked door. And you go there and ring a bell, and somebody comes and looks you over very carefully, and finally, after you've presented your credentials again, you are permitted to go in. And I really think that one of the great thrills in my life was when I saw that document of Tituba's, and here is this cross. And do you know that most of the people who are involved in that period in witchcraft in Salem could not read and write, and most of that material somebody has made a cross. Yes.
Oh,
has
it's
made
heartbreaking.
Yes, it is.
It?
Yes, it is. But and because in addition, you don't know what you're signing.
Mm-hmm.
You can't
That's
read
right.
it.
That's
right. You cannot read it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've done a lot of writing in other fields, tell us something about that, and do you think that helps you in your work as a novelist?
Well, I think I think novelists, I have a kind of prejudice about that, but I do think the novelists write biographies better than other people, because they have become accustomed to, in the first place, making a thing move so that people will want to read it, they'll want to finish it, that kind of thing. Yes. In fact, I think all the different kinds of writing, they support each other. They help each other.
Well, did you do writing in the advertising field? Mm-hmm. And you did newspaper reporting, which also would help you in your gathering of facts forth. And I have one more question before Dr. Schachter takes you back, and that is about the theater. Now, I know that you've interested in theater, and you've written. Have you written plays?
No, I've never written. I did. I wrote some children's plays. I did write some children's plays.
Plays?
Yes. Not commercially. No. I mean, you know. But anyway, about the theater, when I first lived in New York City, I decided, I was struggling to write short stories, and I decided that I did at some time want to write a play, and in the meantime, I would join an amateur theatrical group, and I became a member of what was called the American Negro Theater, and we lived and had our being in the Library Theater on 135th Street and 7th Avenue. And we were there for at least 2 or 3 years. And many of the people who were involved in that theater became famous. And they included people like Ruby Dee, Harry Belafonte, Fred O'Neill, Helen Martin. The list is endless. And they came out of that grubby little theater. Because I have heard people complain today about theaters, but they don't know anything about what it can be like, where there are no dressing rooms really other than a little cubicle. That kind of thing.
It sounds wonderful.
It was fun.
Your works now appear in other languages, don't they?
Yes, they
do. Tell us how widely are they
translated. Well, the novels are, I think, practically in all the languages, Spanish, English, French, all the European languages, Czechoslovakian, all the Scandinavian languages, Japanese.
And your children's books, Harriet
Tubman,
in
France, in Holland. I don't know where else, but there particularly, yes.
And they are still in print.
Still in print, oh yes.
Constant demand for these books. do tell us in some detail how you go about organizing your writing task. Do you begin with writing a plot outline?
Well, usually I begin with people, because they make the plot, and the plot should really stem from the kind of people that they are. And I have always, and I can't think of a time when I didn't, I have to know how the book or the story is going to end before I start, because then the whole thing builds to that.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of The Street, which was the first novel that I wrote, I had written the whole book before I wrote the first chapter. And when I wrote the first chapter, it was the most amazing thing, because I sat down and it just simply seemed to write itself. And it's one of the few things that I ever wrote that I didn't have to go back and do a lot of editing. It just, that's it. And
you,
it's
do
there.
You generally have to do a lot of rewriting?
Oh, endlessly.
You do.
Yes, I
You're
do.
A perfectionist.
No. I just feel that if you write things, people ought to be able to understand what you've written. And in order to do that, it's very rarely that you can write off the top of your head and people will understand it. You know, there's that old business about easy writing's cursed hard reading. That is true.
Do you write daily? You do. Tell us something about, you were mentioning to me previously, the importance of a journal for you.
Well, I write in a journal, and I do this every day, and I do it because, for the most part, people don't remember things very well, and even to the point where they couldn't say a month ago where they were or what they were doing. In addition, it has seemed to me in recent years particularly, all of us should write and keep a journal. And we ought to do it for the benefit of our families, our children, because there are things that happen to us. We are unique, each one of us. We're all different. And that uniqueness ought to be recorded somewhere. And unfortunately, I think historians are going to have a devil of a time in another few years, because people don't write letters the way they once did. And historians, in order to get hold of a particular period, they have to have letters and diaries and journals and things like that in order to make it authentic. Some of the most interesting of the journals and diaries were those that people kept during the Civil War, when you knew what food cost, when you knew what they ate. You knew a record of life during that period. Well, to me, probably because I live right now, but I think this is one of the most extraordinary times in the world in which to be alive, and there ought to be a record.
Do you refer to your journal
often
when you're concocting your short stories, for
example? Sometimes. Occasionally, if I feel there is something that I can't quite remember that I want to put in a story, then I go back and look in my journal.
What are the special techniques involved in your writing of short stories? You generally have a very powerful ending, but what else do you think is essential?
Well, one of my friends say, you sit at a typewriter and sweat a lot. But you have to be able to create in that short space, in a very few words, a believable character in a situation which the reader can understand, and it has to be done very quickly. And that is the problem, because, yes, a novel, you can meander, you can go down all kinds of side paths, you don't have to stay right on the main road, so to speak, but you can't do that in short stories. You have to do this all very quickly and in a very small space. And there is here, I think, the same difference there is between a mural which covers a great wall and a miniature, which is a tiny painting done maybe on ivory or something like that, but very, very small. And to work in that small space, I think, is a great challenge.
That's a succinct analogy, really. Your short story, like a winding sheet,
yes,
in tone and ending, reminds me of your novel, The Street, even
yes,
to the same last name of the protagonist.
Yes.
Big difference, of course, is that The Street had a much more tragic, violent
mm-hmm.
ending. 1.5 million copies of your novel were sold. What kind of fan mail did you get from its readers?
Fascinating, really, and much of it, there was a collection at Boston University in one of their libraries there called the Ann Petrie Collection. So if you want to go look at my journals and my correspondence, it's all up there.
In Boston University.
Boston University,
Libra.
But the most...
Temple
the letters. Well,
we didn't
the
get
letters, they came from everywhere, all over the world. And they still come because the book is available usually some in paperback. It will disappear for a while, then it comes back again and again and again. So it's been through I don't know how many different editions.
That ending still chokes me. I want to know, are you more hopeful about the Lutie Johnsons of today?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I guess I would say that if we survive this long into this year, 1975, and if you stop and think of where we came from and how into this country, and who's the great bookmaker, Jimmy the Greek, wouldn't have given odds on our survival. But we did survive and multiplied in numbers, and we have. And so therefore, I think the odds now are that we will survive. I don't say better. I just say I think we will survive. I hope.
What suggestions can you offer to young people about how to get published and about how to survive during the period when they're struggling to get published?
Well, first, survival, because that's the important thing. After all, if you're not here, you can't write, so you have to survive. And I think that the only, really, I think perhaps everybody ought to read Thoreau's Walden, where the message is simply, you simplify your life. You even simplify the way you eat, the food you eat. You eliminate all what I call the junk food, all the soda pop and the potato chips and all that kind of thing, because this isn't going to build your energy at all. You eliminate that. As far as clothing is concerned, I think one of the greatest things in the world that ever happened was when people began to wear blue jeans. Now, this is a perfectly practical way to dress. Inexpensive, easy to maintain. You no longer have to go to dry cleaners and all that kind of thing. So that it's a matter of food, clothing, and shelter. And the shelter you keep as simple as you can, and you don't have any extra things around. And if you can live somewhere where people don't look in your windows, well, then you don't have curtains. If the floor is fairly attractive, you don't have rugs. That's from a maintenance point of view, because there's no reason to spend time washing curtains and vacuuming rugs if you can avoid it. So you just make it all very simple. And you get a job that does not tax your brain. Don't let other people use your brain. You get a job where, I don't guess they don't shovel coal these days, but get a job where you may have to use a certain amount of physical energy, but you're not using your head. You save your head for your own work, your writing. Remember that business about Faulkner wrote The Sound and the Fury, I think, in a boiler factory. He was the night watchman. Well, he wasn't using his brains. He was just working on his book. But he was being paid. So you look for jobs like that. And you write, and you write, and you write. And you decide in advance that nothing and nobody, you're just not going to be stopped. No matter how many rejection slips, if this is what you really feel, this is the way in which you're going to express yourself, you write. I've told you how to live. I've told you how to write.
Well, who published your first short story after you'd gone through all of this?
It was published in The Crisis, which was the official organ of the NAACP. And it was because, and I say all of my life is a result of peculiar accidents, because it was published. A reader at Houghton Mifflin, Boston, saw the story and wrote and asked me if I was working on a novel. And if I was, would I submit it for their fellowship award? And I wrote back and said, no, I'm not. But perhaps another year I will be, because it never occurred to me to write a novel. It always seemed to me that was like trying to climb barehanded up the side of a mountain.
And that's how the street got started. What are some of your present writing plans?
Well, I always have a five-year plan. That is, I write a novel, then I write a book for children or for young people, and then, of course, along the way, some short stories. So right now it's a novel. I have to write a novel. That's within the plan. If I ever get the time, I'm going to try to write a play. I've always wanted to.
Great, mm-hmm. great. You carefully structure your novels, generally using a single setting, a scene from the eyes of different characters. This mm-hmm. is true of 116th Street in Harlem, of the Narrows section yes. of Monmouth, Connecticut, of mm-hmm. Lenox, Connecticut, and Wheeling, New York. Are Lenox and Wheeling patterned after Old Saybrook, Connecticut?
Let me see, Lenox and Wheeling.
In Miss Muriel and other stories,
Yes,
Wheeling
is. Yes.
Wheeling is patterned
yes,
after
it is.
Old Saybrook,
very definitely.
Connecticut.
Yes.
And
a beautiful town, incidentally.
I notice, I love these autobiographical references to the drugstore in Drugstore Cat, mm-hmm. in Country
yes.
Place, and Miss Muriel and other mm-hmm. stories. How long were you actually a practicing pharmacist?
Well, I tell you, I was born, literally born, over a drugstore in Old Saybrook, Connecticut. So that you might as well say I've been a practicing pharmacist since I was able to walk, because I had all the rules and the regulations of my own. Probably too long. Anyway,
no.
Oh, okay. All the rules and regulations I knew by heart. And so I finished high school. I went to pharmacy college. I spent 3 years in a drugstore that we owned in the town of Old Lyme. And in the meantime, I was getting increasingly devoted to the man who was to be my husband, and finally decided that I didn't want any drugstores anymore. I was going to write. Are we done?
I think this is it, really. I want to thank you very, very much. We could have gone on much longer. Miss Petrie has been writing for over 30 years, beginning as a journalist with the New York Amsterdam News and winning a Houghton Mifflin Fellowship to do her first novel, The Street. Her second novel, Country Place, was a British Book Club selection. Her short stories have appeared in numerous journals, such as The New Yorker, Red Book, Opportunity, and Crisis, and in countless anthologies like Stories in Black and White and Black Voices. It's been a pleasure to know such a distinguished vanguard author. Thank you very, very much for coming.
Welcome back, and that was a rare archival audio file featuring an interview with the legendary African-American writer, Ann Petrie. And we'll take a break, and we'll be back with our concluding segment for the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast.
I never thought we'd part, but every hour in the day. you hear me say, baby, won't you please come home?
That was the Fletcher Henderson Orchestra with vocals by Evelyn Prayer, known as the first African-American motion picture star. She was president in a number of films by the legendary African-American filmmaker of the early 20th century, Oscar Michaud. That track was entitled Baby, Won't You Please Come Home. In our last segment, that will feature excerpts from a panel discussion on Lorraine Hansberry, the legendary writer, playwright, author of A Raisin in the Sun. And let's listen to this panel discussion.
Serious drama. Serious drama. Drama that has at least the objective of making a larger statement about life. I think sooner or later has to become involved in its time.
Lorraine Hansberry, writer, activist, and author, whose iconic play, A Raisin in the Sun, was the first written by a black woman performed on Broadway. Hansberry's drama debuted in 1959 and was a critical success, earning her the prestigious New York Drama Critics Circle Award. At just 29, Hansberry was the youngest playwright to win. Now a new documentary by a Boston-based filmmaker reveals a deeper, intimate look at the prolific playwright's life beyond her most known work.
It's like I can see my future just stretched out in front of me, my whole future. A big, blank, empty space full of nothing.
Tonight, Lorraine Hansberry, bold writer, fierce activist, and much, much more. Welcome to our 50th season of Basic Black. Some of you are joining us on our live broadcast, and others of you are joining us on Facebook Live. I'm Callie Crossley, host of Under the Radar 89.7. Joining me tonight are Lisa Simmons, director of the Roxbury International Film Festival, Tracy Heather Strain, an award-winning writer and filmmaker of Sighted Eyes, Feeling Heart, the documentary about Lorraine Hansberry that will premiere later this month on PBS. Kim McLaren, Associate Professor of Writing, Literature, and Publishing at Emerson College, and Michael Jeffries, Associate Professor of American Studies at Wellesley College. Welcome to you all.
Thank you, Callie.
Great to be here.
Part of the promotional materials, Tracy Heather Strain, for your documentary says, if you think all you know is Raisin in the Sun, then you know nothing about Lorraine Hansberry. So tell us, broadly speaking, who was she?
Lorraine Hansberry was someone who was born on the south side of Chicago, and she's best known for A Raisin in the Sun, but what she really is to me is an activist artist, someone who really wanted to change the world and decided that she wanted to use art, specifically the theater, as her vehicle for doing that.
So why was this story so important for you to tell?
It's important to me because it's personally important to me. I was first introduced to Lorraine Hansberry by my grandmother because she took me and my sister to see the play To Be Young, Gifted, and Black in our hometown, and I was just really moved by her. I had never met a black person, at least as presented in this play, that was so vibrant and speaking about issues that I'd thought about race and class and gender, and I'm sure I didn't even understand most of what was presented to me, but it really hit me hard and it stayed with me. And then years later, when I decided I wanted to take up Spike's call to make black film, even though I wasn't a filmmaker yet.
That's Spike Lee.
I said, I think there should be a film about Lorraine Hansberry, so she kind of came back to me. And so here we are many years later.
Yeah, this has been marinating with you for some time. So you've been working on it. You've all seen the film, and I'd love to know, Lisa, first of all, you had a hand in casting a part of the film. So,
right.
Yeah,
that was wonderful.
When you
saw
the finished product, and you knew something about Lorraine Hansberry before, of course, what'd you think?
Right. I thought it was amazing. I was lucky enough to have, you know, be a little bit more of a part of that and to see some rough cuts of it. And as Tracy said, I think the most amazing part of it is that you come out of it thinking, oh my gosh, this woman was incredible and such a force and a political force, and how important she was to the movement and the civil rights movement and other movements and other things that were going on. And you know, to me, that was sort of like empowering. It was incredibly empowering to have her, you know, all of her words and what she did and her friendships with other writers and activists at the time was incredible. Right. So I feel like I came away with, I think what Tracy wants everyone to come away with, this better understanding and a different understanding of Lorraine Hansberry, and to feel that now you know somebody so much better than you did before you went into it.
So in the last year or so, we've had an amazing documentary about James Baldwin.
Yeah.
I mean, we're seeing some looking back and looking deeply into some of our artists and activists. But a lot of people won't know Lorraine Hansberry. I mean, they'll know Raisin in the Sun, but they actually won't know her.
Right.
So what is the importance of having her story now at this time?
Oh, it's so important. I mean, they won't know her. Just as an aside, I mentioned I had my students read an Alice Walker story, and they had no idea who she was. But then I said The Color Purple, and they said, oh, I love that play, right? Like they'd never read the novel, but they knew. So this is really vital to bring Lorraine Hansberry to a new audience. I thought this film was extraordinary. I did think I knew Lorraine Hansberry. I did not know her. Now I know her as extraordinary, and I think it's important not only to introduce her and her work and a Raisin, which I think the film also makes me reconsider Raisin, which I think can be kind of trapped in amber in some ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it made me think of that fresh, which is extraordinary. But I also think she speaks to our time, to how art can, how all these students, and particularly my students who are artists, and often want to divorce their art from political and social justice. And she was so clear, especially for people of color, artists of color, that, as Du Bois said, all art is political despite the wailing of the purists, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also what importance it is for our narratives to be controlled by us. So she's just right on time, and I think the film is right on time.
So, Michael, what you do in your real life is to look at these contextual issues around culture. And so when you take a person like Lorraine Hansberry and take the fullness of her story as now been portrayed by Tracy, what are you left with as you think about who she was in her time and even who she might have been in this time?
Yeah, I'm going to start by coming back to some of your comments, Kim, because one of the things that struck me about the film is how many of the struggles and the issues, both with respect to national politics and the politics of the arts, are the exact same kinds of struggles that we have today. So when you say it's right on time, I wish we could pick her up and drop her into 2018, because we need her desperately right now. And I think that's the first piece of it that really struck me is she was insistent on the connection between the political sphere and the artistic sphere. So that's one piece of it. Then on the cultural side, when you talk about her work as a playwright, you've got to be able to look back, and I think the film does this so, so well, at all the writing she did before then.
Right.
This was a person who woke up with a burning desire to write every single day.
Yes.
And she wrote lists for herself, almost kind of journaling. Mm-hmm. She wrote newspaper articles. She had that in her and produced so much before Raisin became what it was. And I think that's an important piece of this, too, is when we think about what writing is, right, it's not just a vocation that you do for some kind
Absolutely.
Of production. It's something that most people do every day as a matter of living, as a matter of breathing, right? And that's I think, who she was first and foremost, was a writer, to the final moments of her life, even, when she's writing a better time ill.
Yes.
I think that's very.
I was gonna say I agree with that 100%. I mean, I was with my partner. We're going that, you know, write, like when she says I am a writer, I'm going to write. You know, you have to have that kind of burning desire. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted to say that I thought her. I just lost my thought about what you said, so I'm gonna pass it off.
Yeah.
But the need to write. And I think it also brings her in, because we often say, well, it's unfortunate that she only had this one. I mean, she had two plays,
right.
But of course, but the second one was less successful. So you might think this was a one-hit wonder in some way,
yeah.
And I think sometimes she gets reduced to that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that your point about her, all the writing that she did up to that, plus
right.
the anonymous writing she did, right,
mm-hmm.
or the pseudonym,
right.
Was really important, that even though this is her magnum opus, there's a lot that went around that.
Right.
So I think it's important to come back to the magnum opus, as you've said, because it was so amazing in its time because of she was a first on many levels. But the real heart of it was that nobody had seen this story before of real Black folks.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that it was so hard for them to get the play. People don't play produced. People forget that. They forget that, you know, it's so successful now. It's put on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the first time was something so difficult and so unheard of. People thought it was a crazy idea to have Black people on the stage in a drama. Okay, so musicals were okay some of the time, you know, and some other things maybe, but not a drama. And it's something that we have to remember, and I think sometimes we still have these issues around dramas and Black representation in films
right.
and television and what's considered normal and, you know, inappropriate for African American writers, directors, and performers. So I think it was totally, totally groundbreaking. And the thing that's so interesting when you talk about Raisin and Sun being in the amber is that in part it's gotten in the amber because it was so successful
mm-hmm.
that so many people who were white were, for the first time potentially, were identifying with the Black
right.
protagonist.
Right.
They didn't want the family to take the money. And they wanted them to move into their,
mm-hmm.
you know, the house that they had purchased. And as Michael Anderson says in the in our documentary, these are the same people that would have probably been upset had a Black family moved next door to
right.
them in real life. And so it's I find it really fascinating to really, there's so much more we could have explored about Raisin
right.
in the Sun, but that notion of the reception of it, and then how people decided to say, well, it's actually just universal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this could have been any family.
At any time.
That's such an important point.
I
just want to jump in. The whole idea of universality, and I've actually written about this, and it's so important that she was one of the first, perhaps the first, to turn that on its head. On the one hand, it can be a dismissal of Black art, right? This could be anybody. And she insisted that it couldn't be anybody. It was any family. It was a very specific African-American family. But at the same time, it's extraordinary to make a Black family the universal, right? I mean, that's what Toni Morrison says. You have to write, the more specific you are in Black culture, by definition, the more universal she is. And she made people see that in a way that had not been seen before, I think. That's what's so extraordinary, right? So that's a plus.
That is a plus. I wanted to take another look, a clip from the film, because the truth that she was writing, that she made into art, was something that Black folks lived, and that in fact she lived.
Mm-hmm.
So let's
mm-hmm.
just take a look, a clip from the documentary about Hansberry's life growing up in Chicago and how it influenced her life.
We live in a ghetto, which automatically means intimacy with all classes and all kinds of experiences. We are one people.
I want you to stand up tall and proud. I want you to speak up clear and loud.
All of these people, our parents, us, were stressed out because of race. Anger abounded because people were second-class citizens and reminded of it all the time. It became a part of our consciousness.
Our South Side is a place apart. My people are poor, and they are tired, and they are determined to live. Each piece of our living is a protest.
baby.
So that's pretty powerful. And we should also add, as people will learn when they see the film, that her family actually took their case to the Supreme mm-hmm. Court after they were being forced out of a neighborhood that was primarily white as they, after her father had bought a house there. So this is very much real life in so many ways through the play and also the expression of Lorraine and who she was as an artist and what she was concerned about more broadly beyond the play.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, yeah. And it was really important for me and the team. I did not do this film alone. We had a team of people that did a lot of research. You see, you know, you look at these photos and mm-hmm. things. It was really important for us to bring out the richness of the South Side and show the faces of the people that were later were in her mind, you know, the kinds of people that would have been in her mind informing her and that she would be thinking of as she was writing A Raisin in the Sun. And even that music is Oscar Brown Jr., who was someone she knew from the South Side of Chicago. So we worked really hard to try to make it, try to get you inside of Lorraine's head, and bring a representation of the African American experience that she had.
So in terms of getting inside Lorraine's head, what people will learn is that Lorraine Hansberry is much more, as we've said, than mm-hmm. A Raisin in the Sun, and that I mean I think one of the things that always struck me was. She's described early on as not a lefty, but a radical.
Right.
And I think it's, she has such of that middle-class black woman hairdo and presence that I think people thought, I'm being for real, right?
That she's this nice girl, like this, she's this nice woman, and she's going to be, you know, invite her to dinner. It's going to be great. But that for just one thing, that the end of that clip where she says, you know, our
Every word of our living
is a protest.
Yeah. Right.
And that says it right there. I feel like that's who she was, and that's why when you said it's so relevant today, there are so many playwrights out there today, so many filmmakers out there today now who are, they might not say that, but sort of following in her footsteps in the way of telling these stories and giving voice to the voiceless and making sure that people understand that these experiences and their deep African American experiences that people are going out to see, you know, in droves, like Get Out or something else like that to say, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, this is actually, let me see if not, and I don't know whether it's, see if I can understand the black experience, but see if I can figure this out and learn something or understand something. And maybe, you know, you guys can speak a little bit to that about how, but it's so much more prolific, whether it's in journalism, broadcast journalism, whether it's in documentary filmmaking, whether it's in narrative filmmaking, whether it's because Netflix and there's other opportunities for people to tell their real stories and tell their stories, that it just seems like there's much more of that.
Yeah, and what I thought, and maybe Michael can jump in here too, is getting back to what you were saying about her being not just a leftist but a radical, which I didn't know, mm-hmm. which is very interesting. And, you know, one of the tragedies of her dying so young is that mm-hmm. it would have been fascinating to see how she evolved and where she moved to in her very sharp critique of American society, right? And one of the things that was most striking to me, talk about relevant, is her critique of white liberalism, right, mm-hmm. and white liberals, mm-hmm. Namely Robert Kennedy, which I knew about that famous meeting, but, like, you know, where was she, what is the role of that element in the perpetuation of the oppression of black people, right? So I thought that was fascinating. She was way to the left of where I thought she was, which was great.
And Michael, again, not just from her personal affect, but she might come off as an integrationist. She married a white guy.
Right.
They were pretty much in sync about, you know, let's work together and continue to work after they divorced later about, you know, what's important here in terms of addressing racism in the country. So from the outset, she doesn't look like she would be the one that's, you know, standing up saying get out. Yes.
No question. And of course, we haven't even really discussed her private life.
That's
and her intimate relations.
That's
and her queerness and lesbian identity, right? And that's mm-hmm. another part of the story that, you know, we really, when we learn about this play in high school, perhaps, or maybe even in a college course, we don't talk about that dimension of
her life at all,
right? Because and to separate art from artists in that way does us such a disservice as fans and as critical thinkers about how this work is produced. And on the point of radicalism, which you mentioned, one of the things that the film makes so clear is that from her earliest sort of strivings and thinking as a political thinker, she understands the Black liberation struggle as connected to all of the other kinds of struggles that we're talking about, right? Colonialism and its effect, the women's movement and sexism more broadly. She doesn't really talk about the queer movement much, which of course is nascent, and the film does a wonderful job talking about the depth of the oppression and the shame associated with homosexuality at that time. But that's what makes it liberatory and radical, right? Is that she refuses to stay in one lane, and in fact gains steam the more she recognizes connections between Black liberation and women's liberation, and so on and so forth.
She was intersectional before.
About Tracy's film is that you got to see that. I mean, it was really clear about who she was and what she was dealing with and how she dealt with that and how she felt about it. And that's what I think. And the whole thing around homosexuality and her, you know, sort of living between these two worlds was...
Parallel lives.
I know, I know that it was an issue when you were making this film or getting the rights and doing anything. Was it sort of telling this story that was so central to who she was as a person?
Let me pick up on that and say, was there a great amount of pushback against, you know, redefining what people's idea of her would be?
No, I don't think there was no pushback. I think that the thing was, we had to create this story from the primary and secondary resources that in the research that we did, because there is no major biography out yet that has had access to her papers, so we're sort of like the first people out of the gate with something sort of, you know, on a larger scale. We didn't have pushback because not that many people have had access to these materials to even know what's there to push back or say, oh, you're doing too much of this or that, or you didn't include, you know, this paper or that paper, because a lot of people haven't seen this material.
Just from an idea of who people thought she was.
So far, no, we haven't had any pushback. But what drove us was seeing that picture of her with the pearls on, and, you know, she just looks like, I always describe it as the embodiment of middle class, you know, African American aspiration in the middle of the civil rights movement. That's what people thought she was.
Right.
A lot of people who see her as an icon, that's what she represents. I can be successful. She wrote this successful play.
Right.
I'm going to go out and I'm going to be successful, which is not it's a good thing, but that's not who she was. You know, that's the thing about an icon. That's not a person.
Right.
And so it was really important for me to present this person that was very multidimensional. And I say very, she's organically a part of the major movement.
Welcome back. And that was a panel discussion on the PBS documentary done on Lorraine Hansberry in 2018. And we're continuing our commemoration of International Women's History Month. And today we looked into the lifetimes and contributions of Ann Petrie and Lorraine Hansberry. That's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast for Saturday, March 23rd, 2024. We've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. If you'd like to have access to this program, go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And you've been listening to the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast. And we'll be closing out with the music of Billie Holiday, the legendary Billie Holiday. This has been the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast. And this is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off. And have a beautiful, beautiful week.